Access number 28671, Mr. Ronnie Wheatman, Rio 7. Now, we're talking about the training, you know, on this GOAT.
Yes.
That's a code word for the Type 64 mobile setup.
Yeah.
Now, what sort of training were you doing?
The training you did at 8 o'clock in the morning, you were told to assemble. You got with your gear, which was a 3-tonner, 215 mm weights, and a Jeep, and you were given a point on the map where you had to go. And you had to set up your gear, and you had to be there as fast as possible. And when you had set up your gear and you were operational, then it was recording how long it had taken you. And everybody had to work absolutely in the order that was stipulated to do the different types of work. You had to fit into it, and the cooks and everyone else all helped in doing things. They didn't do the operating when it was finalised, but they did assist with the general work. This went on.
Now, how did you set it up? So how would you set up Type 64 mobile?
Type 64, well, it's aerials. You had six lots of branch aerials, which were they were dipoles, and you had to get them absolutely perfect into the areas where they had to be. There was no quarter of an inch out or anything, because it wouldn't work. And every area had to be absolutely perfect in rotation and stepped down in various angles. And they all had to be fixed correctly, so there was no movement of friction of any sort. The actual cables themselves, they all had to be you worked on a socket system which interlocked in and then turned. Now, on the turning of that socket, you ought to be careful you didn't jump, as very often did occur, you know, and you screw in anything when it's hot. Of course, everything that you touched was damned hot, and sometimes you've been out in the sun, on your fingers it was hot. So we ought to be careful that everything that you did was perfectly synchronized. Perfectly synchronized, it wouldn't work. We did that for about 3 weeks. And then we were told that the three of us would be allocated. We had to go back to Bombay to a naval place called HMS Braganza 3, which is on the outskirts of Bombay. And we had to learn to drive an amphibious craft, a duck, where our gear would be mounted on that. Three of us went for a course of, I think it was 3 weeks or something. It was totally different being on a Royal Naval station to an RAF station, because on an RAF station you had bearers to look after the inside of the hut. They cleaned it, they made your beds, they tucked your mosquito nets up, and when you went in the for your meals, you didn't take knives and forks. They were laid down there for you, and you didn't queue up for meals. It was brought to you by bearers. The Royal Navy didn't do this. You had to take your own cups, your own plates, and this, that, and the other, and you queued up. And also, nobody made your beds. Well, three of us, we the first day, we didn't make our beds, and we got audibly reprimanded. Why haven't you made your beds? I said, well, we pay a bearer to do that. Oh, no, in the Royal Navy, this doesn't occur. So we had to adhere to their rules and regulations.
Now, what about learning to drive a duck? That's what you were there for.
Yeah, now, we learnt to drive a duck.
Now, what was a duck like to drive? Remember it?
Yes, it was a wonderful thing, because you could attain speeds of up to 60 miles an hour. The problem was, of course, engaging into the prop shaft when you were going into the sea. And the place where we trained at was a place called Mard Island. It sounded crazy, Mard Island, M-A-R-D Island. And there was quite hefty surfs there. And we had to train to go into the surf, straight into it. The water would come over the front of the duck. But you had no account to get broadside, it would turn you over. So that was drilled into you, and you persevered with it, persevered to engage the shaft and to not to exert the engine as much as possible against hefty waves, because it was, of course, a problem in the engine itself, of course. But each one of us passed out.
And this was in April 45, about.
Let me think. No, this would be after, it'd be about May 45, this was. May 45. Because I passed out from that. There were three of us that came back. And when we came back to the camp at Belgaume, we did not know that the war in Germany had ended. And of course, when we got up at the station, the staff there was all laughing and giggling, and we asked them, what's the matter? Oh, you Englishmen, you go home very soon. War finished with Germany. And we couldn't believe it. When we phoned up the camp to get us back, we couldn't understand their giggling and laughing, because they'd evidently had a lot to drink. And they said, oh, it'll be a while yet before anyone picks you up, because we're very jubilant. Tell me, go back to camp. And of course, all the camp was that they were in, you know, oh, this is marvellous. But you see, we were still fighting out there. And the next morning, the commanding officer drew us all together and said, well, today was free to do whatever you wished. That there were free drinks in the canteens, and a special meal had been put on. And there were murmurs from a lot of people there as to why we were still fighting. Well, of course, it was a ridiculous thing to say, was that, because the Japanese were extremely aggressive and were still in Burma and still in other countries in the Far East. So we had a hell of a day regarding drink, but the next day we had to come back to reality. Again, we had to go to the the flight lieutenant that was in charge of our section of the radar that I was on, and tell him about the ducks that we'd been driving and what was inside and all the rest of it. We were there about another 6 days, and then we were posted to a place outside Bombay called Kalyan. Now, Kalyan is...
Do you know how you spell it? Sorry.
Yeah. Calyan. Kalyan.
Now, is this the whole lot of you went there?
No, there was about... There'd be about 64 of us, because we were special units. And when we got there, there were eight of us. They said, well, you have been drawn to a special sort of job, and you were going down to Ceylon, because it was Ceylon in those days, and you will come under the direction of Special Air Services. And we didn't know then what it was all about until we were flown down to Ceylon. And when we got there, we were immersed with various army troops and navy, and they told us what we had to do. We were going to be transported to some islands off Borneo, and we would languish there for about 3 weeks at the most. And of course, this is highly dangerous, because what you'll be doing there will be solely reporting movements of Japanese aircraft and Japanese naval vessels. And you would live in a swamp area. You would have a mosquito net. You'd have what is called K-rations to keep you going. They were concentrated food in little tins and God knows what. But they were full of a lot of protein. And we were given 24 hours. That was all as to what we were going to do.
So you were briefed on your role. And this is do you know the names of the island? Off Borneo.
Off Borneo. I couldn't tell you where they were.
Did you have any time to train or prepare?
No whatsoever. There were six of us. And they were what they call WOPs, wireless operating units. There were two that were wireless operators. The other four were there to give report, you know, to rec recognized aircraft, the Japanese aircraft or Japanese naval vessels. We were taken to a squadron which was operating Catalinas in Ceylon. We took off and they flew us at very low altitude just over the sea down past Sumatra and down quite a distance from Singapore, but way out, right out to Borneo. And they, at night time we landed in the sea. They taxied us to some of this group of islands and told us that we would be picked up on such and such a date, which was about 3 weeks ahead.
Now,
and in we went.
Now, so you landed in the Catalina.
Yeah.
What was that like when you actually got, you know?
Well, you were six of you, and we hadn't known one another for a long time, so you knew the capabilities of everyone, but everyone knew that they depended upon everybody else. And we knew that if we were caught, we would be beheaded.
Was it still May or was it into June now?
This was to be coming up into, in about the middle of May.
So, what was the situation when you landed? What could you see when you got off the Catalina?
Well, it was dark at night time, of course, and they put us out in a dinghy with a couple of paddles, and we push paddle away, and we give them maps, etc., as to where we were, and then we had to go into this place, which was horrible, because mangrove swamps are awful. They're full of leeches and horrible sort of insects, which bite like the devil. We had a lot of stuff given us to plaster on our body, and hygiene had to be absolutely...
We'll come back to that. What was this mangrove swamp like? What was it like? Because people don't know what a mangrove swamp is.
Well, a mangrove swamp is just a mass of vegetation all interlocked with roots that go down, and you've got to move your way through them. There are masses of snakes, and some of them were highly poisonous. You had to wear gloves, because the mangrove swamps, some of them were very vicious. They were sharp. So, and if you cut yourself in the tropics, of course, it was highly dangerous. It would fester almost immediately. So everything had to be done so perfect. And I know when we moved into this area, I think we looked at one another and thought, are we going to come out of here alive? And you just wended your way in amongst all these roots, amongst all this mass of insects, amongst snakes that you could see that were all over the place. And it wasn't a nightmare, because you realised you had a job of work to do. The wireless ops made contact immediately with some base at Trincomalee.
Now, how did you establish your base? How did you carry your gear? You didn't have a radar unit then?
We had no radar.
No, this is wireless.
This was wireless. And there were two packs.
So what equipment did you have with
it? It was just a receiver and transmitter unit. And they were very mobile. They fitted over your shoulders. Your tappers that you had was simply Morse code tappers to tap out a signal. Give definition to the receiving end at Trincomalee that you had. It was all done under code words, of course.
Now, how far inland did you in the swamp did you move?
Oh, you moved in about, I would say, only about 50 yards from the entrance.
Now, what did you get a dry patch, or how did you set up your base?
The thing was, in this little dinghy that you had, there were six of us. So you imagine six in a little small area. You had to use the latrine. You just weed everything over the side.
So your base was the dinghy?
That was the dinghy. That was it. Nothing else. And then we had to set up our watches and everything had to be... Everything done to precision work.
Now, how did you organise your work?
Well, you did it in shift work, one at a time. You couldn't sleep because you had netting to put over your face, because there was always masses of insects biting you. You had to put your hands underneath your shirt, etc. Your slacks that you had were pulled down on your boots so that leeches couldn't crawl into you, or they did, because leeches are devilish things. You languish there. Now,
so you just lay sleeping in the dinghy?
Yeah.
How big was it, the dinghy? I'm trying to pick.
The dinghy would be about, I would say, three times the size of that sideboard. It was green. It was dark green. And in it was everything you could think of.
So it was only about 12 feet long?
That's right, yes.
And about 4 foot across?
Yeah. In it was everything you could think of. It was perfectly organised. The SES, of course, had been doing this for a long time. But they picked us because when I think of it, I think to myself, how the hell did I come to be involved in anything like that? And it wasn't until you realise that the Air Ministry in England would send reports of what I had been. I'd been in air crew, I'd recognition, I'd been in the observer corps. All these little things, all put together, gave information to someone who was planning ahead. And on talking to other people, they'd had, there's not one of them been in air crew, but they'd had similar things regarding recognition, or similar things that they'd done in civilian life, which assisted them.
Now, you've told us how you slept. What was a shift like when you were on duty? Tell me what you did on duty on the wireless.
On duty, you had to sit with your legs straight out. You didn't sit crouched or anything, because you'd have got a sort of cramp attitude with your legs out. And one chap was there with his earphones on, and just with his hand on the key to give any notification back. And for aircraft, if we heard them, we knew north, south, east and west, we'd got compasses, we'd give a bearing that X aircraft or X number of aircraft had moved across. We couldn't see in some cases what they were.
Now, would you report all aircraft or just Japanese aircraft?
Well, there were just Japanese in that area. I mean, there was no English went in there, else they were in trouble. They got shot down, of course.
So you just reported the movements of
Japanese aircraft. And also any movement we heard of vessels in the area, you'd hear by the engines as they passed. And day by day went past. And, of course, the logs that you kept. Now, two people kept logs out of the six.
Now, what were the logs?
The logs were just simple books, and you had to write down exactly what took place, when anyone had a meal, when anyone had water. All these things had to be logged, and when contact was made with anyone, or what we saw, or noises of any sort, and we had to take special note of anything that we saw regarding the nature element of coloured snakes, for one thing, which out there are some of the most vivid colours because they're highly poisonous. But all this you had to record in wartime. And the days went past.
Now, what were you eating?
Well, you had these care rations.
Now, tell me that. What were the care rations?
The care rations were in round tins, and they were all, the inside them, when you opened them, were little tiny tins of meat. And that meat was highly concentrated. And, of course, for one little tin, it was sufficient for a breakfast. It was so concentrated. And it kept you going. Now, the problem was water. Because you only were allocated a certain amount of water. So you only had to have a mouthful of water at a time. So consequently, you didn't become dehydrated, but very near it, because you perspired like the devil. And now, hygiene regarding got loose and all that, you did it in turn over the side of the dinghy. You just had to do. There's no modesty, because everybody knew what they had to do. Now, you could not use any paper, because if you'd use paper and it drifted away, we knew that the enemy would know that something was going on there. So you couldn't. You had to wash yourself with this horrible water there, and that was the only, that was what you had to do. But you see, you couldn't, after you'd used your hands in that water, you had to dry yourself on your clothes. You had no towels, and you couldn't shave, because...
Were you able to wash or to shave or anything?
But the only you could only use water on your eyes or on your mouth. You couldn't do anything else, because you only had so small amount of water. You'd have used it all up. That's why you had to be so precise in the amount of intake of water that you took. And we were there, as I said, for 3 weeks, and it was three long weeks.
Now, do you remember, tell me a bit more about the snakes and the creepy crawlies and that side of things.
Well,
that's the sort of thing that people are interested in.
The snakes, of course, the snakes were huge in size, some of them. They didn't molest you, but they would go past you, and they'd look at you, and as long as you didn't belt them, if they belted them, they would come at you. So you just left them alone.
They'd be in the water?
They'd be in the water.
Or on the trees? Or
on the swing, and, yeah. The insects. Now, the insects are insects that you never see in England. In the mangrove swamps, they're huge in size, the beetles and huge things, and they're always fighting one. There's masses of frogs, which the snakes eat like the devil. And there were birds, about. They'd come and look at you, and they'd perch on the side and just look at you, much as say, "What the hell are you doing now?" No, acquisitive look. But birds with beautiful plumage. And we often used to say it's like one hand living in paradise and the other hand living in that. The next moment can be your last. It could be that the Japanese force could suddenly raid you and blow you to pieces.
Did you see many Japanese aircraft?
Yes, quite a lot. Quite a lot. And you see, you could identify. The old Japanese aircraft were given codes called Betty, and I forget them now. But that's the only one I can remember, Betty Bomber. But B was the bomber.
But you could identify them?
You could identify them. You were skilled somehow at identifying them, because all the time that you'd been training back in India, the identification of Japanese aircraft was ongoing the whole time.
So you'd identify them, and then you'd send in a wireless message?
You'd send in a message, yes, back to Trincomalee in Singapore, in Ceylon. Now, when he was coming up to within 24 hours of leaving...
Now, hang on, anything happened while he were there? Or was it really, for all the stress, nothing...
It was a form of stress that you were involved in, because all the time you were looking at the conservation of water, for one thing, you had no fresh fruit, because it would have gone rotten you could have only eaten it on one day. And very often, fresh fruit gives you a tremendous amount of diarrhea if you don't watch out, because it goes rotten and you're in trouble. So there was only this care rations that kept you going. Now, when you got to within 24 hours, it was peculiar, because you realised that the rundown was absolutely had to be precise, and it had to be that you had to move out of that area at the absolute given time. There had to be no sluggishness, because the Catalina aircraft that was coming in to taxi you up knew that it would have been looked at by Japanese radar, and perhaps so low down that they've lost it and wondered where it was. But the Japanese were on a lot of islands. We didn't know exactly the number they were on.
You never saw them?
We never saw them, no. And the Catalina, when it taxied in, would cause noise, which would be heard by someone, whether it was natives. We never saw natives, never saw anyone in boats, never saw anything, but only the noise and bedlam of insects, which is going on all the time. It's non-stop in these areas. Or even at night time, it never abates because there's always things moving.
So how are you going to arrange for this?
Well, it had to be by signals that at a precise time, and that's where your watch is. Everybody's watch, the six of us there, was absolutely, we kept looking at our watches. Everyone was precise.
And where was the rendezvous? I mean, was it difficult to pinpoint?
Well, we went out from this awful swamp area, and of course we had to move out about 100 yards, because other than that, if the Catalina dredged into low amounts of trees or roots or anything, it would have caused perhaps a hole in the plane in itself. And they landed, then they just taxed it on one engine. Two engines, of course, but then, and they'd no lights, and I remember we paddled out and waited, and precisely on time, I often saw, my God, I think it was Royal Australian Air Force that blew us out, but they were absolutely spot on time, and they got the cockpit was open, we could see a chap waving as he came towards us. Now, he had to be careful, he didn't run us down or anything like that at the last moment, and he had to pull in beside us. We got in, we pulled our dinghy in. I've often thought, you know, we spent 3 weeks there living on rations, which were very tight and no water, and we had the very energy to do this, which I've often thought we were in bloody good nick.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. What state were you in?
That's what I can never understand, after being in those horrible conditions of being cramped and night and day, coming precisely 12 hours darkness, 12 hours light, all this mass of insects being bitten as you were, and all the time you got to take salt pills, you got to take mepocrine pills for malaria, etc. And there was another pill that we were given, I forget what that was, whether that was somebody to bolster our sort of morale or what, I never knew, I just didn't. But you at the end, when you pulled yourself, we were assisted by the air crew in the Catalina, pulled us in and slammed the door, and then he turned it round and opened it up, and he took off. And we flew very low, just over the tops, and back to Ceylon. When we landed there, of course, we were taken, first of all, to an area to have a wash, because we were filthy, we stunk, and we had to get shaved and this, that, and the other. And then we had to report. Now, it's strange, the six of us weren't all in the same room. We all had to make a report separate. What that was in there, of course, we'd known one another. There was no security that we were trying to invade one another's privacy. But every one of us had to be taken into a cubicle separate and made to give a report as much as we could on what our thoughts had been. And we were then, the six of us, we were flown back to Bombay, we landed at Bombay, and we were taken back to Kalyan, where we'd originated from, and the corporal said, where the hell have you lot been? We said, oh, we've just been on some island somewhere off Bourne. They couldn't believe us, they thought we're having them on. But we never told them what exactly had taken place. We were under tremendous security.